Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Ian Tuttle of National Review in for Jim Garrity today, who is off at the NRA convention in Nashville. He'll be back on Tuesday. Ian, we've got good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, as usual. We start with the good, and usually we talk about the bad parts of trying to negotiate a nuclear agreement with a radical Islamic regime that is hell-bent on killing Americans and destroying the state of Israel and anyone who disagrees with them. And it's just generally a pretty horrible operation. But the good part is when you have to put out a PR effort to get the deal through over a three-month span, you can pretty much count on the crazy people doing part of your job for you. And that is exactly what the Iranians are doing here. The Grand Ayatollah Ali Khamenei breaking his silence on the framework that the Obama administration has been trumpeting. This is according to the Weekly Standard. He's now accusing the Obama administration of lying about the proposed terms, being deceptive, and having devilish intentions, according to multiple published accounts of his speech. The White House, he says, put out a statement just a few hours after our negotiators finished their talks. This statement, which they called a fact sheet, was wrong on most of the issues. So after all that work of groveling, Ian, it looks like this PR effort lasted, not even a day, really, because by the time the Rouhani got home to Tehran, it wasn't even working.
There are two things here. One is this isn't the first time. When the interim agreement, the sort of original initial agreement that the U.S. and arranged so that they could create the time to negotiate the agreement that we're now debating on, Iran said that the United States was interpreting the terms of that agreement precisely oppositely from what they thought they had agreed on initially. So this isn't the first time. I've been thinking about this, though, as I've been going back and reading something tangentially related. George Kennan's, the famous American diplomat's long telegram and the Sources of Soviet Conduct article that he published both in 1947 that sort of laid out the terms of the containment strategy that the United States took during much of the Cold War. And what he points out is that the Soviet Union, under the guises of communism, was perfectly willing to employ Machiavellian means to negotiate terms that would be best for its system, even if that meant lying and making public statements that were not truthful. That sort of makes perfect sense. They'll lie because the means fit the ends. What's bizarre about the Iranian Ayatollahs is that they've gotten everything they want, just about. And for some reason, they still are not willing to come out and say, yeah, this sounds pretty good. And what they have to do is they have to come out and say that the White House is in fact lying. It's a bizarre strategy for obtaining their own ends. So that raises sort of you can go one of two ways on this. One is, in fact, this is even more sinister than the Soviet Union because they realize how weak-kneed the Obama administration is. And so if they come out and say that the fact sheet and the Obama administration is lying on the terms, then they can push the administration into even further capitulation. The alternative is that they really don't even understand what's in their own best interests. They're too hell-bent, they're too crazy about their fanatical agenda to realize what's in their own best diplomatic interests. And so they might actually doom the agreement themselves. It would be somewhat astonishing given that they have the most willing negotiating partner they've ever had in the Obama administration, and they might end up torpedoing it themselves.
I'm guessing that they've been calling us, you know, the great Satan for so long that they're maybe trying to work it over the next 3 months if they ever are actually going to sign on to anything, rather than calling us the great Satan on one day and then the next day saying, you know what, I think we actually can deal with the great Satan on this one. Good deal.
Precisely.
So, all right, on to the bad martini now. And it's probably a particularly bad martini for Marco Rubio, who is planning to announce his presidential bid for the Republican nomination on Monday. We now know on Sunday, Hillary Clinton will be officially jumping into the presidential race via Twitter. There will be a video involved. And Ian, now, obviously we knew this was coming, but it just seems much like, as conservatives see the rest of Hillary Clinton, just completely inauthentic, very fake and very kind of produced and inauthentic. She's obviously not much of a tech maven, since she thinks that her server was secure because nobody broke into her house. And somehow she's going to announce over Twitter. And it looks like, you know, that once again, because she's kind of stiff on the stump and people don't really like her, the more they get to see her, you know, she's just barely even acknowledging the fact she's getting in the race rather than even making a simple speech here. So that may be good in some way that she won't take too much attention away from Rubio and the rest of the Republicans right away. But it once again kind of shows this elitist attitude of, oh, I guess I'm going to have to play along by the rules here as I get into this race where you should probably just coronate me.
There was some speculation that the email scandal might have doomed Hillary, of course, that wasn't true. But the email scandal and this planned announcement provide sort of a perfect glimpse into Clinton world, this vast and mysterious planet that operates very differently from the rest of much of the rest of the political world. And that is that basically everything needs to be sanitized and pre-produced. Nothing actually happens that isn't already scripted, which should be an indication of exactly the type, exactly the problem, I should say, with Hillary Clinton as a potential president. She has spent years in this cocoon in which she has been insulated from any actual engagement with the problems and exigencies of the world. She can go on stage and read a script, or better yet, she can sit in her living room and deliver a pre-recorded video message that she's had multiple chances to cut, recut, edit, all of the rest, so that it looks exactly perfect, so that she can play sort of this Hillary Clinton, the character, Hillary Clinton, the lore and legend, rather than Hillary Clinton, the flesh and blood human being, who, as we saw in the email scandal press conference, is cold, defensive, snappy, generally unlikable. That's all been very clear as the consequences of this email scandal have sort of unwound. And so it's telling, I think, that the Clinton team wants basically to keep her out of a truly public eye, that they want to make sure that she can remain as insulated for as long as possible. That should be very encouraging to Republicans who would have to face her in debates that are live, that would be challenging her in, you know, on stump speeches where she would have to be live. This may be sort of a glimpse at a key chink in the armor for the Clinton campaign.
All right, on to the crazy martini now. And Ian, as you and I chronicled when we were together last week, a number of days, as well as obviously a busy news week. This week, there's a lot of major challenges going on in the world. We saw terrible job numbers at the end of last week. There was the massacre of Christians in Kenya. There's the complete collapse of any sort of order, it would seem, in Yemen. There's the ongoing threat of ISIS. There's threats all over the globe. There's challenges at home. And President Obama this week decided to focus extensively on calling for an end to psychiatric therapy treatments aimed at changing the sexual orientation or gender identity of gay, lesbian, and transgender youth. It's known as gay conversion therapy. And there's two ways to look at this. Obviously, the president, once again, jumping in with both feet on an issue that probably doesn't need presidential attention, especially when there are other major things going on. And once again, the president jumping in on an issue and the media joining him with no context or balance whatsoever in basically cheerleading a cause. Obviously, if there are teenagers whose parents are forcing them into this, that's one thing. But there are a lot of teenagers out there who have certain instincts that wish they didn't have them, and they would like some therapy for that. But of course, those stories never get told.
Right. There's, of course, frequently a religious element to this, too, sort of a conscience element, which the president is certainly not going to address. There's a real sort of hypocrisy on this issue, though. I mean, what we've seen with Democrats, and especially sort of the hard left, is that issues of gender and sexuality are absolutely whatever you may believe about yourself in these terms, that's absolutely your own prerogative. There's no give in allowing anyone else to have any point of view, any perspective on that. If you say you are a woman, you're a woman. If you say you're a man, you are a man. We just sort of accept that this is the state of things, and nobody else has the right to say otherwise or question or any of these things. But that often has medical consequences, that you see people born male transitioning in the lingo to females or vice versa is perfectly acceptable. But when you, say, have a person who has bodily integrity disorder in which they want to amputate one of their legs because they think that, you know, an appendage is making them less whole, then that's something that everyone is opposed to. So there's this bizarre sort of hypocrisy. I don't mean to put it too glibly, but if it seems okay to you to want to cut one of your legs off because that makes you whole, that's a horrible thing. But if you want to cut off or replace your genitalia, that's a totally permissible decision of your own conscience that nobody has the right to question. The left has no logical consistency and no broader philosophical context in which to think about questions of gender or sexual orientation or any of this. Really, what it boils down to is just a knee-jerk progressivism that accepts a sort of radical sense of autonomy that you as an individual, when it comes to these sort of deep personal issues, have totally unalienable rights and prerogatives to do whatever you want, and the force of the government should be brought down upon anyone who might oppose that. But there's no overarching framework to understand or to legitimize or help to provide a framework for that decision. So what it boils down to is whenever the left finds a cause that they like, they jump on it. And whenever someone opposes that, they jump on them. Whereas I think if you look on the right to a lot of thinkers, Robbie George at Princeton, Carter Snead at Notre Dame, you have a lot of people who have given serious thought to a consistent philosophical framework for thinking through these ideas. That's extremely important. The right needs to understand that that's out there and be able to sort of present that argument coherently and cogently. Otherwise, you just have left-wing politicians who play on sentiment and passions, and that's a very it's a very dangerous state of affairs to let get as out of hand as they seem to have gotten in recent years with all of what we're seeing related to gender identity and the rest.
Right, and demonizing anyone who won't just go along and, in fact, not pick up the pom-poms whenever anyone does
absolutely.
Of these sorts of things. Amazing stuff. Ian, thanks very much for being with us today. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you later.
Thanks so much, Greg.
Appreciate it. Ian Tuttle of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Tune in on Monday for the next edition of the 3 Martini Lunch. Have a great weekend, everyone.